Vihinoa Madonna Eloheinu Aleinu Ma'aseidero Kununa Aleinu Ma'aseidero Kunenehu. Shalom Aleichem, Baruchim Abayim, welcome everyone. Be'ezrat Hashem, we continue our shiurim in the foundations of Torah. The Hilchot Yosodei Torah of Rabbeinu HaRambam. We're holding in the fourth chapter. Now, this fourth chapter, in its totality, has, I think, here, let me count them, 13 different sections, if you will, paragraphs, laws, or whatever. And the first nine of which I'm actually not going to cover. The first nine sections, the first nine laws, deal with the structure and format of physical matter. Rambam is discussing the traditional elements of fire, wind, water, and earth, and the different combinations of which make all the different forms in the physical world. I debated whether I wanted to discuss this, and after a long struggle, I decided, you know, to try to help you understand what Maimonides wrote way back in the 1100s, and to extrapolate, but maybe that's not even a real correct word, but maybe to extract from what he wrote to make the teachings there applicable in light of modern science by explaining his terms in a modern science. That's what I mean, extract from his words the essence and to apply it into a modern scientific detail. Is, of course, It's an interest of study that, in my opinion, is way too academic for my tastes. In other words, I feel that such a pursuit does not necessarily provide for us today that which Rambam originally intended for his words to provide. And therefore, the reason why he wrote what he did, I believe, is more important. And that he discusses in the final few laws of this fourth chapter. And this is something that we have to understand. Rambam discussed all the topics that we've been talking about in our previous, well, this is our eighth, so our previous seven classes, about the nature of spirituality, the nature of what we'll call our multiverse. Multiverse means our multiple dimensional universe. It's a term that does not have its origins, mind you, in mysticism or religion. I actually heard it used by Professor Michio Kaku, a physicist from, I believe, New York University, on his show, his television program about the universe, broadcast weekly on the Science Channel. Modern science recognizes and knows now many of the intricate subtleties of the nature of our multiple parallel universes, correctly to say, things of which our sages have spoken about for thousands of years. Now, Rambam discusses the nature of God. He spoke about the nature of angels. He spoke about the different relationships of spheres and planets and their consciousness. And then he went into a discussion about the nature of physical finite matter. And you can say, gee, this is all well and great and cool and groovy and all that, but what does it have to do with Torah? Well, as we're about to learn, it is not only about Torah, it is the fundamentals of Torah. And that is the reason why Maimonides chose these topics to put at the very, very beginning of his compendium, which is a comprehensive review of all the laws of the Torah. Now, one of the great things that we really have a problem with today in religion in general is mythology and fantasy. For many, many years now, most likely centuries, we have had an academic orientation towards the study of Torah, which unfortunately takes certain Torah teachings of the Torah, the prophets, the writings, as well as that of our sages at face value,
and understands them exclusively in some type of literal fashion. Indeed, this is a misapplication and a grievous misunderstanding of the original meaning and intent of the texts. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is quoted in the Holy Zohar as stating that if all there was to the Torah was just its simple stories that we see at face value today, he says something so radical that we could write a better one today. That's right. He says, at surface value, we have these stories. Once upon a time, there was an Abraham, an Isaac, and a Jacob, and they did this, and they did that, and we have these genealogies, and this and that. And we sit and read, and we believe that these surface value stories are all that there is to the Torah. And again, the great Tana himself stated, no, if that's all that there was, we could do better today. And indeed, think about it in this context. If we were contacted by an extraterrestrial race, maybe they are the angels spoken of in the Bible, or some higher race, and they come down and they communicate with humanity, and they provide for us a bridge of communication, a body of knowledge. We might find that body of knowledge, even in its most superficial and fundamental form, to be so radically advanced that it would take our best science to understand it. All the more so would we question whether there are deeper and deeper levels and strata in it that we couldn't even possibly yet understand. There was a film made many, many years ago dedicated to the astronomer Carl Sagan. I believe it starred Jodie Foster. It was a film called Contact. And it presented a similar type story to what I just said. That for the first time, mankind received a message. And the message that they received from outer space was a radio signal that we sent out from Earth back in the 1930s. You don't have to get into all the details of the story. And we're looking at this and said, gee, that's what they're sending back to us, our own signal. But they found, coupled within our own radio signal, multiple levels of plans and technological data. And while they were trying to understand the data, looking at it in a standard graphical two-dimension format, they couldn't make heads or tails of it. Finally, one scientist comes and says, look, these are aliens. They're probably more advanced than we are. And maybe they see things in a different dimension than they are. And he took the diagrams and he put them three-dimensionally as opposed to two-dimensionally. And he was able to break a code which enabled them to build a machine which enabled them to make contact. This is all well and good when you want to talk about a story, a make-believe story of a plot of a movie. But don't you realize that this actually did happen thousands of years ago when we had made contact on Mount Sinai? And the contact that we made wasn't with one of the alien races who, like us, are equal creatures created by our mutual creator, but rather that creator itself reached out through multiple levels of parallel universes. Michio Kaku would have been impressed, and spoke. And Rambam, of all people, describes the experience of Mount Sinai. And in all due respect to Cecil B. DeMille and his 1950s version of the Ten Commandments starring Charlton Heston, the giving of the Ten Commandments wasn't like it's portrayed in the movie. Everybody heard this deep baritone voice say, I am the Lord. You know, that's all well and good for the old movies. But Rambam says that when the Torah was given, all the people heard was a single sound. That's right. The word he uses actually is a voice. But a voice is sound, same thing. And it was undifferentiated into words. That all they heard was a sound. Oh, I don't know if it sounded like that or not, but something like that. And they only heard its distinction as words in their minds, but not in their ears. They, in essence, saw it and understood it psychically. This is the meaning of the pasuk in the Torah where it states that the people saw the sounds. The Creator communicated telepathically the Torah at Mount Sinai. It did not speak to the intellect and to the academic interests of the people. It was, in essence, like a program ingrained and written onto the hard drives of our minds, etched into our DNA. We were essentially and fundamentally changed. We are taught that in the beginning God gazed into the Torah and created the universe. And therefore, the entire universe existed primordially in the Torah. We have to thus ask, what exactly is this Torah that God gave us? And the only answer that we can honestly describe it as, the ultimate essence and foundation, the blueprint, the guide of everything in our multiverse. This existed within the Torah. Therefore, existence is an expression of Torah. And thus, as the Torah emanated from, the universe, multiverse, emanated from Torah, therefore in each and every detail of the universe is a reflection and an echo of Torah. And therefore, one can see an echo and reflection of Torah in everything, in every single natural phenomena that we know and that we see. And that we do not know, and that we do not see, and that one day we will know, and one day we will see. It is today a point of mockery to discuss issues of what is referred to as the supernatural. Things that are above the academic mind to explore and discuss. Well, the boundaries of science are expanding exponentially. The boundaries of science are including today things that even a decade ago were inconceivable. Things that a century ago would have been inconceivable. Things that 200 years ago would have been considered blasphemy. Can you imagine sitting down with the likes of Copernicus, Galileo, as intelligent as they were in the study of astronomy? Can you imagine studying with Isaac Newton? Albert Einstein and Isaac Newton having a conversation about the difference between Newtonian mechanics and maybe the theories of relativity? How about Stephen Hawking, who sits in the same chair at Cambridge University that Sir Isaac inhabited? All right, I shouldn't say have it. He had the chair. Can you imagine them discussing the difference between Newtonian mechanics and quantum mechanics? Newton wouldn't know what to make of it. Speaking about multiple parallel universes, he would have thought it was mysticism. His mind would have been blown. And this is a period of just a few hundred years, barring the coming of Mashiach, or all the more so if he does come. What kind of discussion will scientists be having, not in the year 2008, but possibly in the year 2308 or 2408? The things that are considered to be today science fiction might in that day be long accepted science fact. My, how times changed. The entire universe is an echo of the original source, which we call Torah instruction. Rambam endeavored in the first four chapters of his Yesodei Torah to lay down for us these foundations, to help us recognize and realize that Torah is not just about religion. It is not just about a once upon a time story that we all have to accept and acknowledge and follow. Once upon a time, there was this lovely, sweet man named Abraham, and he had a son named Isaac, etc., and so on. Rambam, in spite of the fact that he is proclaimed the chief of the rationalist school, many of the Mikubalim through the ages have always claimed that Rambam indeed was privy to the secrets of the Torah. I myself am of that persuasion, for I see in his words their meaning, their intent, and it is indeed the same meaning and intent that the prophetic Kabbalists have always taught throughout the centuries. Even though some of his specific applications may be different, intent and meaning for teaching them the way he did is the same. He writes here, and for brevity's sake, I ask your indulgence, I'm going to read to you these words of his in English, just so we don't have to worry about translation. I don't have to be repetitive. I am using the English translation, published by Moznayim Publishing, and I believe translated by Rabbi Eliyahu Tutor of Israel. So from the 10th law in the 4th chapter, after discussing all these physical and what we call metaphysical concepts, Rambam states that all these concepts you've explained in the context here are like a drop in a bucket. These are deep matters. Nevertheless, their depth does not approach the depth of the subject matter of the first and second chapters. In other words, when he talks about these last two chapters about the nature of the universe, stars, planets, the physical matter which makes everything up, the consciousness of the stars, he says, these are all deep things. These are the secrets of physical science, as he's about to tell us. But they don't even touch the depth of what we can call metaphysical science. You see, as we speak of the multiverse and parallel universes, each of which exists in accordance to a natural law unique unto itself, these are the realms and the domains of which we call the levels of heaven. This is the difference between the physical and what we call the spiritual. The spiritual is such a nebulous term that I actually despise using it, because it has no absolute meaning. We must recognize that our pursuit of these parallel universes is the discovery of actually what we have come to know as the spiritual planes. And as life exists there, it is radically different than it is here. Being that we have not yet, scientifically speaking, got into the realms and the domains of these parallel universes, there is nothing that we can really say about them. We don't know the nature of the subatomic particles there, and what types of forms they take, and what type of life might be there, and what forms that life might take, and what levels of intelligence or wisdom or transcendence it might be. For us, scientifically speaking, at this present time, it is all unknown. Or as Rambam would say, really deep matters. But he continues to discuss these third and fourth chapters here, and he states, the explanation of all the subject matter in the third and fourth chapters is referred to in Torah as Ma'aseh Bereshit. And he states here that the sages of the early generations commanded that these matters should not be expounded upon in public, but rather a single individual should be informed about them and taught them. What is this? Rambam's understanding of Ma'aseh Bereshit is, if you will, the study of physical sciences. But his understanding of physical science, and that of the Kabbalists, is curiously similar. You see, when we talk about the physical sciences, we talk about the secrets of Ma'aseh Bereshit. He's making a reference here to the second chapter of Masechet Hagigah in the Talmud, in the Mishnah, where it states that the secrets of Ma'aseh Bereshit should not even be taught to two people, but only, if you will, a teacher to one or to two students at a time. It is considered one of the greatest and deepest secrets of the Kabbalistic schools. And the texts associated with them include the Sefer Yetzirah. Now, for those of you who have ever learned the Sefer Yetzirah or have taken my course in the Sefer Yetzirah, know that I teach it in the way that it was meant to be taught, as a meditative text to the expansion of human consciousness, to the point where human consciousness can touch the fundamental elements of creation and manipulate them according to will. And that is not even a mystical or a metaphysical concept anymore. Science is understanding in what's called the M theory from the string theory how everything in the universe is somehow interconnected with everything else, and then somehow there's this collective consciousness. Jung speaks of humanity having a collective level of objective psyche, a collective level of the unconscious where we're all connected. Well, deep down, we're all connected with a whole lot more than just one another. Now, to manipulate the forces of nature, to recognize what they are, how they are, and what we can do with them, these are the secrets of creation. Granted, Rambam, in the third and fourth chapters here in Yesodei Torah, did not get into the realms, the levels and depths that are discussed in the likes of the Sefer Yetzirah. He did not discuss meditative techniques of a specific type, or teach people about the fundamental elements, or I should say, how to manipulate those fundamental elements. He just explained to us that they're there. True. And indeed, this basic review is the fundamentals of our Torah. It is the secrets of one of the greatest of the Kabbalistic schools. Rambam's intent and purpose here is to include these within the greater scope of the laws of Torah. Why? If this is only to be taught one-on-one, and it's not for everybody, why then does he put it right up in front for everybody to see? The Mishnah Torah, Rambam wrote, with the specific intent that it should be read by the common man, that everybody should have access to these teachings, that everybody should learn them, that everybody should know them. And if so, why is he writing about topics that he himself states shouldn't be taught in public? And actually, it's a trick question. Because he himself didn't talk about the Sefer Yetzirah or anything else. Now, did he? There are no totally acceptable connections of the Rambam to Kabbalistic literature. There are a number of texts out there which quote the Sefer Yetzirah, which are claimed to be written by Rambam. I will leave that into the hands of the scholars to debate back and forth whether they were or not. But nonetheless, Rambam does not discuss the Sefer Yetzirah in either his Moreh, in his Mishnah Torah, or in his other commentaries that are classically used. But yet, he betrays his knowledge, his wisdom of these things, in the way and means of how he writes. So the deeper levels, that is meant to be only passed on to those who are ready and trained and experienced to use them. But the knowledge that these things exist, not necessarily the techniques of how to use them, that everybody should know. Everybody should know the fundamental foundations, and that is why he writes these things here. Continuing, in the 11th halakha, he states, so, now that we've described this Maaseh Bereshit, what's then the difference between the subject matter of Maaseh Merkava and Maaseh Bereshit? Maaseh Merkava, traditionally understood as the study of Ezekiel's chariot, of chapter 1 of that book, again, the tractate Hagigah states that even this Maaseh Bereshit, we only teach one, two, no more Maaseh Merkavah is even a more restricted type of learning. As Rambam states here, the subject of Maaseh Merkavah should never be expounded upon, even to a single individual, unless he is wise and capable of understanding, in which instance he is given the fundamental points we call Rosh Hashanah. Now, what is this Maaseh Merkavah? This is the study of what we today call prophetic Kabbalah. The meditative techniques taught also in the Sefer Yetzirah, but also expanded upon elsewhere, not with the intent to be focused upon the fundamentals of the building blocks of this universe, but a meditative technique to completely transcend all levels of physicality in every multiverse, to literally know the ladder of ascent through the multiverse and the parallel universes to the ultimate source, the source of sources, which is none other than, of course, the Creator, the Holy One, blessed be He, God Himself. That source, which opened up to us at Mount Sinai and gave us the Torah. And I might add, if you will review how the Torah was given at Mount Sinai, there was a vortex, a wormhole opened up through parallel dimensions from which came forth God. Now, no one saw God's face. No one saw the image of a man on a throne. There was no image. The Torah says that very clearly. Right? And yet, the sound went through. And again, Torah teaches that God created the universe, multiverse, through sound. God spoke, let there be, and there was. And how interesting that modern science finds a coincidental similar theory that the most fundamental form of subatomic particles are not these little dots of matter, but these, what do they call, vibrating strings of energy, vibrating in movement, movement creating sound, and therefore they say poetically that the whole universe is like one great orchestra playing the beautiful harmony of existence. How interesting that the two speak in similar types of terminologies. Maaseh Merkavah teaches us how to connect to that source. It is a comprehensive exploration of the human mind, delving into the deepest essence and realms of the human psyche, penetrating into the human unconscious, going through the uncharted territory there, deeper and deeper, beyond, or I should say deeper than the level of the collective consciousness of mankind, into the collective consciousness of our universe, and then deeper to the collective consciousness of the multiverse, and deeper to the collective consciousness of the source of the multiverse, the Torah itself. And beyond to the collective consciousness of everything. That is the Creator, the ultimate universal mind, the true definition of God, as we described in the first lesson in this series. Now, you can imagine that such in-depth meditative training, such exploration of the mind, is not something that anybody and everybody can just pick up and do like you would learn to ride a bicycle. Oh no. It is a task that a person has to be psychologically prepared to undertake. And those of the more rational, academic, philosophical orientations are of a mindset in complete contradiction to this type of pursuit. And therefore, those who are so overly academic, philosophical, will never succeed in the experience of the Merkavah. Oh, they can write 500-page books describing everything. But you know, people who need many words really are making up for what they lack, which is even one experience. That's how you can always tell the difference between those who know and those who think they know. Those who think they know have to write a million books on it. Those who know, they don't have to write a thing. They just know because they've experienced. And I've given the comparison to the act of marital intimacy between a man and a woman. A person who is a virgin can go to school and get their PhD in sexology. They can read every dirty book and see every dirty movie ever made. And they can become a complete expert in every aspect of human procreative activity, in every form and fashion. But as long as they're a virgin, they still know nothing. They still lack the fundamental spark which could take all that knowledge and make it real. And yet, one with that spark, one with that experience, has an awareness and an insight that the one with all that academic knowledge will never, ever be able to understand. And so it is with this material here. Ma'ase Merkava is not something that one can teach another. All one can do is point one in the direction and guide them to cultivate their own psychic, spiritual, extrasensory experiences. And that is why it says here you can only teach them what he calls the fundamental points. And that's why you can't do this in a class. You can't teach this to 30 people, 3 people, or 2 people at a time. A point that we recognize from the Torah, Maimonides is going to make mention of later in these Torah fundamentals here in the laws speaking about prophecy, is that no two prophets ever experienced God or never saw the same type of vision. Everything was different. Everything was unique. And the reason for this is that the uniqueness of humanity is that we have the filter and the faculty of our human mind. And our human mind is a filter which is unique to the individual. And as each individual penetrates beyond the boundaries of consciousness into the realms of the unconscious, into the realms of the archetypes of the collective unconscious, and goes into the realms of archetypal, intuitive, pictorial language as opposed to words, each one's experience is unique to the individual, different from another. And as such, no two can ever see the same. So one who guides students in Ma'aseh Merkavah can only do it one-on-one. Think of it, if you will, as in-depth analytical psychoanalysis. If you are an analyst and you have an individual before you who needs your attention to go into their own psyche to deal with their psychological problems, you can't deal with a class of people. You can't analyze 3 or 4 people at a time. It's a completely unique experience to the individual, and therefore it can only be one-on-one. And as psychology knows, a therapist can't just analyze the person and say, okay, this is what's wrong with you, A, B, C, D. I think they've been in business for 30 years. They can look at a person in 5 minutes and give you their entire DSM outline. And you tell that to somebody, and you might as well be talking to the wall. Because, okay, they'll acknowledge it, but there's no integration, there's no experience, there's no realization. The entire process of therapy is the analyst's endeavor to open up the individual to experience and see these things for themselves. This is exactly the role of the master prophet to the junior prophet, teaching the secrets of Ma'aseh Merkavah, the secrets of prophetic Kabbalah. And this, unfortunately, is so misunderstood today. Rambam, he understood this. Oh, big time did he understand this. But this is why he writes the way he does. He knows who can understand what and how. But with regards to the secrets of creation, the fundamentals of our universe, he states the subject of Ma'aseh Bereshit may be taught to an individual, even though he's incapable of comprehending it with his own power of understanding alone. If I and you want to have a conversation about the nature of the multiverse, what's new in quantum physics and M-theory, subatomic particles and parallel dimensions, you and I both will sit there and our heads will swirl and go, wow, that is like really cool. But do you and I really understand all the mathematical understandings and equations that go into this? Stephen Hawking's Michio Kaku, great physicists, minds of our time, can write books, but they write books for the layman at one level, and write other books for their peers at another. How many of us think that we could sit with Albert Einstein and have a conversation at a level of where he is at? Not many. But yeah, we could still have a conversation with him and say, can you explain to us time dilation, the relativity of time, the relationship of energy to matter? Come, yeah, sum it up in a simplified form in a couple of sentences. That's why we can understand these things. But the abstract realm of the unconscious, that is not an academic pursuit. That requires experience. So, even in this study of the Sefer Yetzirah, the first chapter of that book teaches the meditative techniques of what one is to experience, so that when one touches the fundamental fabrics of the universe, which we call the 22 letters of creation, the 10 Sefirot, that the mind will have some level of experience of recognition so that they can successfully integrate what it is that they're experiencing. Ma'aseh Bereshit, the study of science, is a profound thing. Unfortunately, in our day and age, we have come to such a fundamentalist split where in which religion is interpreted in such a radical, literal way that science is considered the enemy. Realistic understanding of the universe is considered the enemy. I'm sure Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai turns over in his grave when he hears the fundamentalists today speak. When they hear the likes of Copernicus being called an apostate because he said that the earth is not the physical center of the universe. Okay? All of our sages' astronomical statements were within the context of the best understanding of science in their day. And as science developed, so the understandings of our sages developed and changed. But unfortunately, the fundamentalist mentality rigidizes itself to the point of appearing foolish, primitive, mythological, and stupid. And it's a shame, it's an embarrassment, and it's a disgrace to the Torah when we hear so-called religious leaders, so-called rabbis, pontificating such literalness in the face of reality. It makes them and our Torah appear foolish. And they are creating a grievous, what we call Chilul Hashem. They are doing a grievous harm to the ultimate exploration of the mind and the expansion of knowledge in the universe. They are doing a terrible, terrible thing. And here's something queer, weird, bizarre. Atheism, the belief that there is no God, belief only in science, has taken its own radical fundamentalist turn. And today we have a movement of radical atheists who are as fundamental in their pursuits as are the fundamentalists of any religion. I have gone so far to describe modern atheism as its own religion, with its own fundamentalism, with its own jihad. Right now in December 2008, we are close to the time of the Christian holiday, and a story has arisen here in the news in the United States, where at which a civic display of the holiday icons, the Christian symbols and the Jewish symbols, they decided that it would only be appropriate to have a display of the atheist symbols. And the atheists therefore came out with a sign that states, there are no gods, there are no angels, there are no demons, there is no heaven, there is no hell. All of this is primitive nonsense, make-believe, and fairy tales, and intelligent people don't believe this stuff. It's the prison for the mind. And you know something? When I see this radical thing, unlike many co-religionists who would say, blasphemy! Evil! No. I recognize where they're coming from. And in essence, what they are condemning has always been the literalness, the fundamentalism, and the mythologies, and the fairy tales that have grown up around our religious stories. No, they don't believe that God could be. They're, as I said, they're fundamentalists. They don't believe that it could possibly be an intelligent designer. That's their problem. But at the same time, in their radical antagonism towards the Creator, as weird and bizarre and strange as it sounds, they're actually performing the Creator's purpose in attacking the mythologies and fantasies of religion, which we know by another name called idolatry. That's right. The atheists are actually successfully attacking and destroying idolatry. How weird and bizarre is that? The people who think and claim that they are working against God are actually working for God. What a strange world we live in. Now, understand. Rambam continues here with regards to his understandings of Maaseh Bereshit. A person may be informed about everything that he can possibly know about these matters. So, why aren't they taught publicly? Why don't we always espouse the most deepest and profound scientific lessons? If you'd ask that to Einstein, Hawking, Kaku and the like, or even in the old days, to Newton, they would have given you the exact same answer that Rambam gives here. And that is, because not every person has the vast knowledge necessary to grasp the interpretation, the explanation of these matters in a complete manner. Who can understand how the depths of these things? We should know that they are there. We should recognize the profundity of our universe, even though if we can't really grasp every detail about what it's all about. Rambam states this is a fundamental of our Torah, specifically with the intent to free our minds from the mythology and the fantasy, just like Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai spoke about in the Zohar. And you could say, gee, I guess the Rambam read the Zohar. To which the answer is, well, no, it's really only published, you know, many, many decades after his death. But there are those people who want to say that Rambam had a pre-published edition. He had the original manuscripts. And you could say, well, I don't know if that could be ever proven historically and the like, but there are interesting things that Rambam writes in these first four chapters, which have a strange similarity to only one other source in all Jewish literature, which just so happens to be the Zohar, which he supposedly never had access to. So, we'll leave the historians and the scholars to debate that one. Why is all of this written? Who cares? Don't we have to deal with Torah mitzvot? But of course, and Rambam writes here, when a person meditates on these matters that are discussed in these first four chapters, the metaphysical, the scientific, Maaseh Bereshit, Maaseh Merkava, and he says here, meditates. The Hebrew word here is mitbonin, which is a contemplative meditation, which transcends the limits of the academic mind and goes delving into the realm of the unconscious, which we can call into the intuitive and the psychic realms, where in which the mind consciously goes off and taps into the unconscious, which is an open highway and a door to the collective consciousness of humanity, of our world, of our universe, of the multiverse. You can flow in time and space and come to recognize all the creations, I'm reading Rambam now, the angels, the spheres, man and the like. And what do we do all with all this? You appreciate the wisdom of the Holy One, blessed be, in all these creations. And this will add to his love for God. His soul will thirst and his flesh will long with love for God, blessed be he. Rambam is writing a book about laws. Continuing. He will stand in awe and fear from his humble, lowly, and base nature when he compares himself to one of the great and holy bodies. How much more so in comparing himself to the pure forms which separate from matter and do not share with any connection with it. He will see himself as a vessel full of embarrassment and shame and empty and lacking. Now, Rambam is trying to help us understand just how minute and insignificant we are as a human race on this little itsy-bitsy planet revolving around this insignificant little ball of light sun in one of the six arms of the Milky Way galaxy, which is part of a greater cluster of galaxies, which is part of this great universe, which is only part of one of the many multiple universes in the great multiverse. And yet, somehow, in some way, we're still all connected to the source. And as we have access to the source has access to us, and therefore there's this great union and connection. To acknowledge this doesn't really transform you, but to experience it definitely does. And the commentaries say that all that Rambam has been enumerating here in these four chapters is the fulfillment of the first five commandments that he enumerates here. They're obligatory upon every Jew, and I might add, to every non-Jew, which are, number one, to know that there is a God. Number two, to know there is a singularity, to unify God. Number three, to love God. Number four, to fear God. Number five. And love and fear should never be understood in the metaphorical, mythological framework that there's a little old man sitting on a cloud somewhere, and you better do what he says or he's going to get you, right? He knows who's been naughty or nice. Come on. That's the fantasy that we say about Santa Claus, not about the universal mind and the ultimate consciousness of existence. Now, Rambam continues here in the 13th law, which thus concludes this chapter, and he states, the matters discussed in these four chapters concerning these five mitzvot, which I just enumerated to you, are what the sages of the early generation termed the paradis. And again, he's making a reference to an experience discussed in the tractate Hagigah on the 14th page in the second chapter there about the four who entered the paradis. This was the four great sages who went and had a meditative experience in higher dimensional planes. And one looked around and died. One looked around and went insane. One looked around, became an apostate, and only one entered and exited in peace. I have written about these great four sages and what all of that story means in my book, Walking in the Fire. I will encourage you, for those who wish to pursue a deeper meaning of this specific Talmudic passage, to reference my chapter in my book. Rambam is referring to these four as going into the depths of Maaseh Bereshit and Maaseh Merkava, just as a little peripheral. These four did this at a time parallel to the Bar Kokhba revolt, where in which there was the potential impossibility for the restoration of the Jewish kingdom, and hopefully the end of what would have been a short exile, but to avoid the great long one which we have suffered through. And they all went on a spiritual pursuit to try to conquer the psychic and spiritual source of evil in the human psyche. And unfortunately, they failed. They were fundamentally trying to change physical matter and at the same time change psychic reality to, in essence, shift the universal paradigm and to, in essence, project us into a parallel universe. Unfortunately, they failed. Now, Rambam says about these four that even though they were great men of Israel and great sages, not all of them had the potential to know and comprehend all these matters in their totality, which means they didn't have what it took to complete the mission for which they endeavored to accomplish. We say that someone will come in the future, the Messiah, Mashiach, and he will indeed rise to that level wherein which his consciousness will tap into the universal mind, called the Keter, and as such, be able to manipulate and shift and move all the universe with his thoughts. That will be the coming of Mashiach when its time comes. But with all of this being said now, what does Rambam want from us? And he states that he, Rambam, his personal opinion, that it's not proper for a person to stroll in the Pardes unless he has filled his belly with bread and meat. Meaning, bread and meat refers to the knowledge of what is permitted and what is forbidden, and similar matters concerning the other mitzvot. He says these great and profound and deep contemplations are all well and good. But as we've said, not everybody has what it takes to really delve into them. So therefore, should everybody make all their efforts to try? Nails, no. Rambam's opinion is, you know, practically speaking, people can only take on what they're capable. And therefore, these types of pursuit are only successful with a more mature and capable and trained mind. And therefore, they should only be pursued at a later age. It is based upon this that some people have interpreted that the study of Kabbalah should only be pursued at the age of 40. And even though that you have the great sages of all generations who said that's not true, from the likes of Rabbi Moshe Cordovero to modern sages like Rabbi Avadi Yosef, says that person, 20 years old, mind is old enough. But all of their reference is to the academic, philosophical pursuits of Kabbalah. The vast majority of people studying Kabbalah today, the vast majority, almost everyone in Hasidic circles, and almost everyone in Sephardic circles, are only studying the philosophy. They never study the reality. And that is why their Kabbalah might be intellectually stimulating, but it is far distant and removed from ultimate experience and truth. Not everybody has what it takes. Practically speaking, therefore, people have to deal with and learn what is, let's put it bluntly, priorities. As Jews, we have obligations to live by Torah. We might not understand it, but that's irrelevant. We still have to do it. You do not have to have a full involved physics understanding of the laws of gravity to know that you don't jump off a 5-story building. You just know you don't do that because you know what's going to happen. You don't have to understand physics. Shabbat, Kashrut, Tefillah, Chagim, Taharat HaMishpacha, family purity laws. All of these behaviors are multidimensional realities which take their construct form in the mitzvot that we have to perform that Rambam enumerates before us in the rest of his code. And later rabbis have enumerated in various forms. Being that we live in a multiverse, being that we live in a quantum reality, which means that not everything is so precise and rigid, but more fluctuating and fluid. Jewish law is alive and fluid and a reflection of the reality of the universe, which is why we have so many parallel observances, which we call minhagim, with Sephardic, Ashkenazi, this way, that way, but they're still all connected to the source. And it's like a vibrant, living organism. Rambam states, you might not understand what it's all about. That's okay. But you still do it. And it's in the doing that comes the connection. The doing is what taps us into Torah and gives us what might be our only psychic connection to the source. And thus he says, even though our sages refer to these Torah mitzvot as small matters, sages, of course, quotes here Maaseh Merkabah, something big, Gemara study, halachic observance is something small, still, we give it precedence. Because it says here, it settles a person's mind. When you connect with the Torah, Torah Hashem is called Tamima, which truly means it's simple. And then it says, the rest of the verse, Mashivat, Nafesh, it restores the soul. When we observe Torah mitzvot in simplicity, we become attached psychically, intuitively. And it is only that which provides us the door and the opening to anything greater. So first, we have to have the attachment to the house. Only then can we sit in the room. And only then can we open the door. And only then can we walk through it to higher realms and dimensions. This is why Torah mitzvot must be there first. That's what Rambam writes. And he says, to conclude this chapter, there are great good which the Holy One Blessed Be has granted to allow for a stable living in this world, the acquisition of life in the world to come. It's the doing. Lo ha-midrash ha-ikar ela ha-ma'aseh. It is not the learning, but the doing that counts. Because the doing grounds us in this world and connects us to the parallel worlds, which we call here life in the world to come. And they can be known in their totality by great and small men and women, whether expanded knowledge or limited knowledge. Everyone can learn how to observe the Torah, whether we truly understand its depths, like Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai refers to them, or not. With this, we conclude the beginnings of the fundamentals of Torah. And Rambam now will proceed to elaborate to us how to fulfill other mitzvot, other ways and means of connection that enable us psychically and intuitively to be aware of the universal mind, God, and to be a part of greater creation. Bezrat Hashem will continue those classes in our future lessons in this series.
Baruch Adonai Le'olam. Amen.
Amen.